Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Univision has promoted English only in this debate. Yo tengo mucho orgullo de ser latino y no tenemos que tener ningún problema en hablar nuestro idioma.
Democratic presidential hopeful and New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson. That was about all the Spanish that was spoken in that debate last night. And try to make sense of this. Last night's Democratic debate was limited to English only, but broadcast on Univision in Spanish only with English subtitles. One way or the other, the Latino vote is likely to matter next year more than ever. And our first guest today is the executive editor of El Diario La Prensa, the biggest circulation Spanish language daily in the New York area, Alberto Vervulius Bush. He has been executive editor of El Diario since 2005. Before that, he was editor of the magazine Art News. And before that, deputy editor of Time Magazine's Latin American edition and a research associate for 4 years at the Council on Foreign Relations. And he happens to be married to the novelist Jhumpa Lahiri. Alberto Vervulius Bush, thanks for coming on today. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for inviting me.
Maybe my pleasure. Maybe since I just did your bio, we should establish that you are no relation to President Bush, true?
That is correct.
Did you watch the debate last night on Univision?
I did indeed. It was the exciting thing for me was that it happened at all. It is the first time that presidential candidates for a major party debate in Spanish, and that was the historic part of the debate.
But not really in Spanish, in English. What was that about that Richardson objected to exactly?
Well, I think part of the ground rules were so that those candidates who didn't speak Spanish didn't feel they were at disadvantage. It was agreed to by all the candidates as part of the ground rules that they would all speak in English.
And listeners, if anyone listening right now happens to have watched the Univision debate last night, we want to hear from you right now. Call us at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. What was interesting to you about this debate, other than the simple fact that it happened, which was historic? 212-433-WNYC. Any other Latino listeners, even if you didn't watch last night, what was interesting? What is interesting about the dynamics in this race to you? 212-433-9692 or post your comments at WNYC.org. Immigration was given more time than any other topic in this debate, not surprisingly, and all the candidates supported a path to citizenship for people now here illegally. But here's another clip from the debate. It's Hillary Clinton after she was asked about the idea of a fence along the U.S.-Mexico border.
Well, actually, I do favor much more border patrolling and much more technology on both of our borders. And in certain areas, even a physical barrier, because I think we've got to secure our borders. That has to be part of comprehensive immigration reform.
Both of our borders referring to Mexico and Canada. But Alberto, do you think Senator Clinton's answer on the fence came as a surprise to the Univision audience?
No, that has been her position all along. Part of the question was interesting because the broadcaster asked if the candidate supported the construction of a border of a fence along the Canadian border as well, given the fact that more of the terrorists who participated in 9/11 came across the Canadian border, none came across the Mexican border, trying to sort of like spotlight the way that national security is used in as a sort of like a, I don't know, as a Trojan horse in the immigration debate. So the question was interesting. It threw, I think, most of the candidates for a loop because I don't think they're used to thinking about immigration or being questioned about immigration that way. And I thought that was one of those genuine moments in which certain candidates were able to go with the idea that you can separate immigration from national security and have two separate debates, and others relied on their rote, standard stump speech, like Senator Clinton.
My guest on WNYC, Alberto Vervulius Bush, editor of El Diario La Prensa. Let's take a phone call. Angel in Weehawken, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling, Angel.
Thank you very much. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Doing great. How about you?
Good. No, I just called to, my mother was very pleased yesterday at the initiative that Univision had the broadcast in Spanish. No, she only speaks Spanish, but, you know, she's a registered voter, and usually I have to help her figure out what's going on in the politics. But she was very pleased, and she thought that the candidates came across very informed to make a better decision.
Did she like anything, like anyone in particular, and did you, just based on their answers last night?
I think she got some interest in reference to Mr. Edwards. She thought that he presented himself well. And also, she seems to support Senator Clinton, but I think she saw Mr. Edwards come across better, you know, with the translation and his thoughts.
Okay, Angel, thanks a lot for calling. Please call us again. And David in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Yes, good morning, sir.
Hi.
It's hard to phrase this without offending people. I'm a Latino, but first I consider myself an American, and I speak English first.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm asking my fellow Latinos, that if my parents came here from España as immigrants, learned to speak English, write English, we should make big efforts to learn the language. And I find it somewhat embarrassing, and it's concerning to me that you know, that there's accommodations being made for us, which, of course, I appreciate, but if you're going to make accommodations for us, then we should be making accommodations for Chinese Americans and for Albanians and for Russians and for other new immigrants that are coming here that don't speak English but would like to have something like last night done for them. That's my concern.
Alberto?
Well, I believe that the primary thing that in a democracy is to have informed citizens, and informed citizens who can to understand what the issues being debated are, what their options are, and I think it's important that people receive quality information, and the language they receive it in is going to be the language they generally tend to prefer and feel most comfortable in. The reality is there's an awful lot of Americans who feel comfortable in Spanish. Just like in previous generations, there were an awful lot of Americans.
It's disrespectful because I've just spent, yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you, I'm sorry, but I've just spent living 5 years in France. No one in France, when I went into Germany and to Italy, they didn't make accommodations for me. I just think it's disrespectful, particularly this country has been wonderful and generous to me and to my parents, to learn English.
No, don't worry about interrupting. There's an obvious difference between the immigration model between the United States and Europe, and in many regards, the immigration model in the United States works better than the European model. At least there aren't immigrant riots at least some people have argued that.
And David, thank you for your call. I guess part of what is at issue here is, what is the U.S. model, and what is it going to be in the future? I mean, realistically, and tell me if you disagree with this, as a matter of political analysis, the reason that an accommodation is made to hold a debate in Spanish or for a Spanish-speaking audience is because there are so many more Spanish-speaking voters than Chinese-only voters or, any other language group. And so, for example, the question was asked last night whether Spanish should be a second official language. There is no official language at the moment, but whether Spanish should be a second official language of the United States, and only Dennis Kucinich said yes. So I guess that question of what the relationship between English and Spanish, between the United States and English and Spanish, are or should be very much in flux.
Absolutely. It's very much in flux, and it's very much a political issue, an issue that the politicians are either talking about or trying to avoid as much as possible. And that was another interesting question because, routinely politicians are asked about English as a national language or official language, and it was interesting to see that reversed and the possibility of their discussion of Spanish and whether it should have some recognized place within the official gaze. As you just pointed out, I mean, different governments provide services in different languages, not just Spanish. In New York, government services are provided in almost 80 different languages, and in other places more or less the same. So these are broader issues for the society to discuss, and things that usually get swept under the rug in the heated debate about immigration reform.
Jasenia in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jasenia.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good.
I was calling. I unfortunately didn't watch the debate last night, but I'm a Latina born here, and I wanted to respond to the previous caller regarding the seemingliness of special treatments of Spanish speakers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we should focus on really is the fact that I think as your speaker said already, we need to be more focused on the fact that we're getting information and information is being disseminated, and the reality of this country is that not everyone gets the information freely and as forthcoming, and any attempts to increase that is a good attempt.
Thank you for your call. So there are different points of view on this, but Jasenia, how many languages? I mean, in New York, you know, there's people from almost every country on earth. Should New York debates be held in 40, 50 different languages?
Well, I think it's not necessarily. Obviously, we would want everyone to be able to have the debate done in their language, but the reality is there are a lot of Spanish speakers here, a lot of people who are voting, and what we need to do is we need to increase awareness in all languages of what information is being presented and what positions are being presented by politicians. And it's kind of ludicrous to say, well, let's not do it in Spanish because it's going to give them more advantage. We need to find ways to give an advantage to all individuals and not diminish that advantage.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. Of course, it's hard enough to get politicians to debate in English.
Right, or say things that actually are specific answers to specific questions
right.
in English. Jasenia, thanks again for your call. Alberto Virilius Bush, editor of El Diario La Prensa, my guest on WNYC as we talk about the Democratic presidential hopefuls debate on Univision, the Spanish language station, last night. Latinos are obviously growing fast in population, recently passing African Americans in total numbers. But give me your most real political analysis on how important you think the Latino vote will actually be in this primary season in determining the presidential nominees of either party.
Well, this primary season may be different in the sense that because it's front-loaded and because the top, I think it's something like the top 10 states with Hispanic voters, with percentage numbers and total number of Hispanic voters, all vote either on February 5th or before February 5th, there may be much more of an impact to the Hispanic vote. Normally, in the normal election years, most of the larger states with Hispanic voters, like New York, California, and Florida, vote late in the cycle. So by that time, everything is decided. There are no more competitive races.
Right. We know Florida's going early, and New York and California, as well as New Jersey and Connecticut, are all on so-called Super-Duper Tuesday.
That's right. And Arizona and New Mexico, Nevada. And so the states
also
the
in there on February 5th.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a very large block, not of votes in general, but also those states with the highest Hispanic population.
But from what I heard, this will be true in terms of the Latino vote potentially swinging the election to one Democratic hopeful or another, mostly in certain states, Florida, where the debate was held, and states in the Southwest, but not yet New York or New Jersey. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I tend to agree with that. It's early in the campaign season yet, and these sorts of debates are important because I think voters haven't yet focused on who they support and who they don't support. Like your first caller, I think, was a good example of that. But certainly New York and New Jersey right now don't look like very competitive races in the primary. But it's hard to tell. It's early in the season.
Here's a clip from the debate. Senator Christopher Dodd of Connecticut on the longstanding U.S. economic embargo against Cuba.
50 years of this policy of the embargo has basically left the same man in power, the same repressive politics, an economy that's been failing in the country. He has been using that as an excuse for his own failures. As President of the United States, I would begin to unravel that embargo.
Should I assume that answer would make Dodd unpopular among most Cuban Americans?
I think it was a courageous thing for him to call for, given the setting of the debate. Yes.
And before we take a break, let me ask you about.
But I also think there is a constituency. There are many Hispanics out there who have a more distanced sort of relationship to the Cuban embargo who might agree with him.
Let me ask you about Barack Obama. How much crossover appeal do you think Barack Obama has to Latino voters as the first person of color who might actually win? Does that cross over at all? Has it been measured?
I think Barack has crossover appeal, but not because specifically because he's the first person of color who might actually win, but rather because he speaks about urban issues in a very compelling way, with a certain language which I think crosses over very nicely from sort of like English to Spanish. So I think there's a series of issues and a sort of vision for the future, which is very appealing and which is appealing to African-American voters as well as white voters and Hispanic voters.
And I'll just mention briefly, and then we're going to add another guest and talk about some other things, but Dennis Kucinich was the only one who said he would repeal NAFTA. He's always said that would be his first act, which he said is partly responsible for the surge in illegal immigration from Mexico. And only Kucinich, as I mentioned, said he would support Spanish as a second official language of the United States. I think Dodd was the only candidate other than Richardson who actually speaks Spanish. But with respect to Kucinich, are either of those stances broadly popular among Latinos, the NAFTA one in particular?
Well, not really. I think NAFTA, there is a set of the population in Hispanics who feel that free trade and NAFTA have hurt not only the U.S. economy and workers here, but also workers in Latin America. They tend to be a small percentage of the total vote. But there is some issue about that. The Spanish, I think, as a second national language was an entirely rhetorical question, and I don't think there's much constituency behind that.
Real quick, how is Bill Richardson, the only Latino candidate, doing among Latino likely voters?
Well, I think Bill Richardson does very well in the Southwest, where he is known. I don't think he's really raised his profile and isn't really known in other regions of the country.
Among Latino voters in other regions of the country.
That's correct, including among Latino voters in other regions of the country. And I think it helped him to speak in Spanish during the debate and make a point of the fact that he was able and willing to do so.
All right. We will add to Alberto Vervulius Bush, the executive editor of El Diario La Prensa, Michael Duffy, who wrote this week's cover story for Time magazine about Petraeus coming to Washington to issue his reports. Are you surprised, folks, that he'll be testifying before Congress about whether to stay in Iraq on September 11th? We'll be talking about that in a minute.
The truth of the matter is that the Americas, this administration's policy and the surge are a failure, and that the surge, which was supposed to stop sectarian violence and long enough to give political reconciliation, there's been no political reconciliation.
I can claim success in that the first part of the equation is the vital part of any political success, and that's security on the ground.
Senator Joe Biden first on NBC's Meet the Press, Senator John McCain second on ABC This Week, both presidential hopefuls with different starting points on the Petraeus testimony to Congress, which begins today and continues tomorrow on the troop surge. We continue now with El Diario La Prensa executive editor Alberto Vervulius Bush, and also with us Time magazine correspondent Michael Duffy. Time's cover story is on Iraq this week. He wrote it. It was called Moment of Truth in Iraq. Michael, welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to be here, Brian.
And I am shocked to hear that Petraeus' testimony before Congress has been scheduled for September 10th and September 11th. Are you?
And 12th and 13th. No, nothing surprises me. They don't miss a trick.
I mean, you know, Al-Qaeda from Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia attacked us on 9/11. Bin Laden is apparently still in a safe haven in Pakistan, if his new video is real. We know there's a safe haven there for Al-Qaeda leadership, but the chief selling point for continuing the war in Iraq seems to be that we need to deny a safe haven in Iraq for Al-Qaeda.
The main point of the narrative we're going to hear over the next couple of days is that whatever the original goals of the surge may have been, one of the great benefits of it, unexpected perhaps they will admit, is the notion that in the western part of Iraq they have linked up with the Sunnis and jointly begun to fight Al-Qaeda in Iraq there.
That's the Anbar story.
That's right. And so the administration has never hesitated to play the Al-Qaeda card if it can, and I don't know why it would be any different now.
The New York Times today says Petraeus will ask for another 6 months before Congress even attempts a serious assessment of the surge. How do you think that'll go over?
Well, I don't think Congress has the votes to actually stop at this point. They could pass 50 or 52 votes in the Senate, but they're never going to be able to override a veto in the House. I don't think the administration ever had any real serious decision point here. They always regarded the September moment not as a checkpoint but as a speed bump, something just simply to be cleared, and I never have thought this was going to be a
defining
turning
moment.
Point.
Yeah, I mean the headline of your article, I realize you don't write the headlines, is Moment of Truth in Iraq, and the more I see in recent weeks, the more it looks to me like this is not going to be a moment of truth on Iraq policy. This is going to be, you know, a festival of rhetoric saying why the president's policy should be continued, and the Democratic Congress, with the continuing limited will to cut off funding for the war and limited votes to reduce our participation in any other way.
That's right, and I don't think the administration ever regarded it as anything other than a speed bump. They have always, the architects of the surge, thought this would take 18 months. We're only 9 months through it. Everything the president has been saying privately and publicly suggests he wants to carry it as long as he can, well, not only well into next year, but perhaps all the way to the end into the next administration. He said that in the Dead Right book by Mr. Draper, and so I don't expect any kind of change here. I've always been a little surprised that people regarded it. I think Moment of Truth might have been an ironic headline.
Yeah, right. Alberto Vervulius Bush, I want to play a clip. This is something that Hillary Clinton, I guess, said yesterday. I'm not sure if this came from the debate or not. You could tell me. But after we hear this, tell me if you can explain to me her position on the war. Here is Senator Clinton speaking yesterday.
We need to quit refereeing their civil war and bring our troops home as soon as possible.
Yes, so I could tell from the audience response that did come from the Univision debate last night. Is she for a long-term troop commitment or pulling all the troops out or neither of the above or both of the above?
Well, it would, by the sound of that clip, that statement, she's trying to sound like she wants to pull the troops out. Now, obviously, the detail is when and how fast.
Right. And Michael Duffy from Time, just judging from Senator Clinton's recent statements on the war, she seems to be a little bit all over the place. She has also said things like the U.S. is going to have an ongoing commitment to Iraq. So do you understand Senator Clinton's position?
I think it's very difficult to understand anyone's position here. One of the inertial forces that keeps the surge going is that no one on either side of the issue, or even inside of their own argument, really knows what would replace it. There is no appetite that I can see in the Congress for pulling out completely. If they draw down the 30,000 troops that will be drawn down in the spring, Ryan, they're going to need a strategy, some kind of posture, because they're not going to take them all out. No one has any idea what that would be. One of the advantages everyone recognizes here is that one of the things you get by keeping the surge going is you don't have to come up with an answer to that question. What comes next? The way I look at these hearings and that are going to unfold here in the next couple of days is it's just the beginning of Washington's effort to figure out what comes next. It's not the end. It's the start. This is where they begin to ask the questions they've been chewing on for 3 or 4 months about, okay, now what do we really do? We know this has not worked out. It's pretty much of a disaster. How do we extricate ourselves? We know Bush isn't going to lead the way out. What are we going to take as Democrats asking themselves? What position as a party if we end up with the White House? And how will we do it? And that's the beginning of the conversation that's starting here this week.
Alberto, do you think the war issue plays any differently to Latinos as a group or subsections of Latino populations any differently than to any other groups of Americans? I know it seems to me that whenever I see lists of names of the dead, American soldiers killed in Iraq, there seem to be a lot of Latino names.
No, yes, absolutely. And in fact, the Army, as the armed forces have seen the numbers of people volunteering drop, the armed forces have identified Hispanics and Latino recruits as a place to increase their numbers and have much more aggressive, proactive, targeted effort to recruit in Hispanic and Latino communities. And now, in terms of attitudes towards the war, generally, I think it reflects the larger society. It's similar. They're generally Latinos oppose the war, and because participation rates in the Army are climbing among Hispanics, more and more there's a great growing sense of urgency about what is to be done in Iraq and how it can end and how quickly.
Michael Duffy, is Petraeus really a success story up until the surge? Frank Rich from the New York Times has been pointing out some things lately, like that Petraeus was first hailed as a success for pacifying Mosul, but Mosul flipped back to insurgents' hands after the troop surge of that year in that city was pulled back.
I'm always amazed by how people can imagine that one person, one general, can make the difference in a struggle this massive. They did it with Petraeus. People did it with Abizaid, you'll recall, when he was brought in to be CENTCOM chief. He said, oh, he speaks Arabic, you know. I mean, they're always sort of treated upon their arrival as some kind of savant who is going to make all the difference. And I'm deeply skeptical about that, generally, so to speak, because they all come out of the same sort of system, especially in the Army. It's not exactly a place noted for huge amounts of unconventional thinking. Also, Petraeus was the one who was responsible, we often forget, for the supposed training of the Iraqi army through 2003 and 2004.
And at the time, he called it very much on track, and we know how much that effort has, I don't know if crashed and burned is too strong, but it's certainly run into serious problems.
Right, so I've always thought there was a certain amount of hero worship of Petraeus among the press. The other thing that I think that's much more apparent and quite obvious is that there are huge differences in the general staff about the wisdom of this operation. We know the Joint Chiefs and the Joint Staff in Washington, and probably Robert Gates, the Pentagon boss, the new one, are much more skeptical about the wisdom and the efficacy of this strategy, if that's what it is. And have been quietly trying to get the timetables changed and accelerated so they can bring it to a close. But you know, when you're a 3-star general who's promoted to a 4-star, and you suddenly find yourself to be the hero of the White House, you've got your own chain of command.
Yeah, you don't say no, I'm not.
This isn't a group that says no a lot. So they salute and. So I tend to think this is one of the most interesting things to watch here also we're going to all be listening this week for differences between Petraeus and Crocker, the ambassador to Iraq. I don't expect massive ones, but they do have really different responsibilities, and they've had different levels of success, so we'll see.
Can you fact-check a timeline for me, again to cite Frank Rich from his column yesterday? He said the Bush administration, was already citing the new relationship with the Sunnis in Anbar as a success in January when he announced the troop surge. So if they then turn around and credit the troop surge with it, that would be a lie.
Well, it did predate the surge, and the surge may have actually accelerated. I think when you actually ask them, they haven't linked a one-to-one relationship. But the Al-Qaeda was committing atrocities against the Sunnis at the end of last year, making the Sunnis ripe for being co-opted. It was underway before the surge. Now, don't forget, the surge surge was announced in January. It really didn't get fully underway until May. And so, you know, this has been a moving target. So I all those things are worth fact-checking.
Right. Alberto, any comment on any of this?
No, I do think that much of the discussion, as we move forward, much of the discussion is going to be driven by the primary season and the conversation the candidates are having with the voters right now. I think it's very much a moment in which the candidates are trying to separate themselves from the field by telling the voters, by being clear on Iraq, while at the same time not trying to tie their hands for the fall campaign on a broader scene.
Alberto Vervulius Bush, executive editor of El Diario, with me for another few minutes, along with Michael Duffy, Time Magazine correspondent.
Brian, I would just say that I think there is right that they're trying to walk a very careful line. I think that the leadership in terms of criticism of Iraq has really come from the Senate and the Congress. It hasn't really, and isn't, I don't think we're going to see it from the presidential candidates. I think that they're, especially the ones who think they can get the nomination, I think they're just too worried about boogieing back to the center at the end of the process, and they are taking, it's my sense that they're taking their cues from people in Washington, particularly moderate Republicans, who are in a much tighter spot politically. So I kind of am not expecting them to show the kind of leadership about what to do next, maybe about what they've done, but about what to do next, I think that's not going to come from the campaign trail.
Let me ask you both about the newest candidate in the race, and that is Fred Thompson. He has been on the scene informally. He burst upon the scene officially last week, and I was surprised to see this harsh comment from conservative analyst George Will on ABC This Week yesterday about Fred Thompson.
26 weeks, George. 26, half a year from when he first offered to make of himself a gift to the country and when he actually got in. He said, well, to tell you the truth, I haven't spent a whole lot of time going into the details of their positions, which I believe because he hasn't gone into the details of his own positions.
Alberto Bush, interesting dismissive comment about Fred Thompson. You think there's less there than meets the eye for all the media brouhaha?
Well, I do think that he has a limited window of opportunity to really make himself a serious force in the race, and if he doesn't do well very quickly, I think his campaign may deflate.
Michael,
I don't know how much of his 22% in the Republican polls is really for Fred Thompson, and how much of it is just parked there, a measure of unhappiness with the rest of the Republican field. I'm guessing it might be half or more. Most Republicans believe he took far too long to get in, and he may have missed his moment. There have been other things happening on the Republican side of the race, particularly the rise and consolidation of Mitt Romney that may make Fred Thompson less appealing. We'll see. But generally, hesitation doesn't work in politics, and it suggests also perhaps not the right instinct as a president. Timing and clock and is really important, not just politically, but in terms of running the country. And I'm not sure his judgment here was the right one.
Before you both go, one other thing, and that is on who the next Attorney General of the United States will be. Dianne Feinstein said yesterday that she hears that it might be Ted Olson, who is a leading Republican lawyer and advocate. He argued Bush versus Gore before the U.S. Supreme Court, if I recall correctly, and that apparently they're leaning toward him. Michael Duffy, I don't know if you're on this beat at all, but
I tend to think Olson has the inside track, that he is definitely the flavor of the moment in Washington. He was unusually well regarded by Democrats. This is something for all of his work in some of the partisan cases. He has an extremely high reputation among career and political people in the Department of Justice, former attorney generals and assistant attorney generals. They like him.
Hmm.
They say that while he's got a little partisan streak, most of them have a little partisan streak,
yeah.
He plays fair. It's actually, I was somewhere last night where most of the criminal bar for the Democratic Party was in attendance, and it was hard to find a discouraging word about Ted Olson.
Well, that's interesting. And
you will hear them, though. They're coming.
They're going to come. And talk about selling the Iraq War around 9/11. Olson's wife, his third wife, I've read, Barbara Olson, another conservative activist and author, was killed on 9/11. She was on one of the planes. So I don't know if any political considerations go into that as generating sympathy for Ted Olson or...
No, he was Solicitor General of the United States. I mean, he knows how to argue a Supreme Court case. And he's always been on short lists for a lot of the key judicial appointments. He was a solid conservative long before he married Barbara. But I tend to think he is the one to watch.
Yeah, and Alberto Vivullius Bush, was there sympathy in the Latino community for Alberto Gonzalez as the first Latino attorney general after it dissipated elsewhere?
There was some, yes. His performance, though, left much to be desired, and clearly by the end, I think there was a great deal of relief that he had moved on.
All right. Thank you both very much for joining us. We really, really appreciate it. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute with Fashion Week in full swing in New York. We will ask the question, is fashion worthy of analysis, or does it just reflect your shallowness? Stay with us.